This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Film, a podcast series on the New Books Network. I am your host, Pete Kunze. My guest today is Yves Benamou, a teaching fellow in film studies at the Université Paul Valéry, Montpellier, France, and the author of Contemporary Disney Animation, Genre, Gender, and Hollywood. The book was published by Edinburgh University Press in 2023. Good morning, Yves. How are you today?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
I'm hanging in there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, great. Well, it's wonderful to connect with you, especially across continents. And to begin, I'm hoping you could tell us a little bit more about your background and your training.
Yes, so I have a PhD in film and television from the University of Bristol. And the book is actually based on my doctoral thesis. It came out of that. And before that, I also had I also did an MA in history and film at the University of Warwick. And so there were the seeds of the project already a little bit there.
Excellent. I always like to ask folks who are revising dissertations into books, because a lot of our listeners are early career scholars. Can you tell us a little bit about the process of how this dissertation became a book?
Yes, so there were the major changes were twofold, I would say. First, the structure. So I had to revise a little bit and make it more explicit. So I have each chapter is more focused on one film or a couple of films, whereas in the doctoral thesis was more structured in relation to themes. So that makes it easier for readers to find exactly what they're looking for. And also in terms of the time period, looking a little bit, expanding the time period, basically. So looking at films, so I looked at films from, in the book, 2008-2018, so a decade, which was a bit more refocused in the doctoral thesis, so more expanded for the book. And also looking at the decade before that, so to understand what is so specific about the decade I'm looking at in the book, I have a chapter dedicated to the 90s and 2000s in Disney, which was not in my doctoral thesis. And also maybe in terms of style, making it more accessible to readers that might be students as well. So I think those might be the main things, I think, as far as I was concerned.
Excellent. So I have a general question for you, and it's a bit of a loaded question since I work on Disney as well. But I'm wondering what brought you to Disney animation and why you decided to do kind of a deep dive into it for your doctoral study and now your first book.
So it goes back to my very first undergrad dissertation, I would say. But I was, while I was studying, I was always interested in themes around gender representation, American cinema, and also politics. And I was looking for a topic that would kind of interact nicely between these three areas. And Disney is fascinating in that regard because it has it is so central in American culture, in American studies, and also it's talked about a lot in terms of gender representation and gender. So I thought that was my starting point. And for my MA dissertation, I was also interested in issues related to the concepts of post-feminism in terms of contemporary representations of women in media, especially in the 2000s. And then Frozen was released, and Frozen was really the catalyst for the PhD and then the book, because it also made me think about the idea of genre, film genres, and looking a little bit beyond fairy tales, Disney films being studied as Disney films in isolation, but looking at all the other generic influences and especially looking at Disney now for the doctoral thesis and then for the book, the starting point was, okay, now that we have Disney owning almost half of Hollywood, let's say, with first the acquisition of Pixar and then Marvel and Lucasfilm and many other things. What defines Disney animated films? Because if you ask people who are not academics, what do you think about when you think about Disney, they will say animated films, and they will tell you about their favorite films when they were kids. And actually, that was my questions was, well, now what is so specific about Disney animated films in that decade? And especially considering the competition from Pixar and DreamWorks and late Blue Sky, and at a time when Disney is no longer the only one doing animation within an Anglophone European context.
So that brings me to my next question, and you've alluded to this already a bit, which is obviously Disney celebrated 100 years last mm-hmm. year, and you've selected for your study this 10-year period between 2008 and 2018. Can you tell us how you decided to delimit your study there? What do you see as kind of evocative about those years at Disney?
There are many reasons. First of all, there were not that many things, works at the time looking at that period specifically for Disney. Usually for Disney studies, the Disney Renaissance is looked at in the 90s, or books also tend to have a global outlook on Disney from the 30s to now. So that was at the time a decade that was not really looked at that as much. And also, when you look at academic books on digital animation, computer animation, you tend to have Disney alongside many other studios. It would be obviously I'm really interested in Disney's interactions with other studios and other acquisitions and other things, but the main focus for me is still Disney. So that's the first element, looking at that specific decade. And also thinking of from 2008, so 2008, you have many things happening. First, you have Bolt, which is released. And obviously, it's 2 years after a major change in terms of Disney management, when you have John Lasseter becoming chief creative officer of Disney. That was in 2006. But Bolt in 2008 is really the first Disney animated film released and supervised under this new Pixar management and hierarchy after all those changes and all those interactions between Disney and Pixar. And this is also the first that was released. Helen Haswell writes about that, the fact that it's released, it was received rather positively compared to others like Meet the Robinsons and the ones that were in the early 2000s. Then in 2008, you also have the first MCU film, Iron Man. Marvel is bought one year later, but also it marks the beginning of the superhero genre as being the most commercially successful, but also the main genre of mainstream American cinema. So that's another thing. So that's looking at that. And then 2018, why end in 2018? In 2018, Ralph Breaks the Internet is released. And I thought it's a very interesting film because it's a film that really looks back. That was before the release of Wish, obviously. But Ralph Breaks the Internet is the first sequel, theatrically released sequel since The Rescue is Down Under. For Disney to release a sequel is very rare and unusual compared to other studios like DreamWorks and Pixar. And Ralph Breaks the Internet explicitly acknowledges what Disney is now. You have those sequences in what is called Oh My Disney, where you have the characters of Ralph and Vanellope getting into the internet and into a website that no longer exists anymore, as it was in the film. As it was at the time of the release, so it's already obsolete. But it was a website that gathered all the latest news on Disney films, Disney releases, Marvel, Pixar, with interviews and games. And the film has that. And you have all those characters from Disney, from Marvel. You have Vanellope interacting with Eeyore from Dumbo, with Stormtroopers. She sees a Stan Lee cameo. And she interacts with all those characters of all those areas and of the Disney Empire. And there's also that very famous sequence when she chats and hangs out with the Disney princesses. So I thought this is a fascinating film to end the book on, because it does seem to reflect on what Disney is now, and also with a heavy dose of parody and self-reflexivity, especially with the characters of the princesses, including a musical sequence as well. So it seems, and also being very contemporary in its sense of relying on spectacular digital animation, relying on action genres, and having this evolution. I mean, I think this film is very interesting because it really illuminates so many changes that Disney faced in that decade. And also in 2018, you have the new chief creative officer of Disney, who is Jennifer Lee, with John Lasseter being replaced. So that's also a decade that that is specific in that regard as well. So, and it also contains so many interesting films. So looking at Tangled, Frozen, in that period, Zootopia, films that have been, that decade is interesting because it had been a while that it's the return of Disney in a way, after the late 90s and the early 2000s, having Disney being replaced a little bit by being replaced by Pixar, the box office, and Pixar films getting all the animation Oscars. And that's period of late 2000s, early 2010s, really is the comeback of Disney, both for critics, but also in terms of box office, with, again, Frozen, Tangled, Zootopia, films like Moana as well. So that's why I chose to focus on that decade specifically.
Yeah, and you raised an interesting point there, and one that comes up in your book, and I think is a fascinating intervention into Disney studies, which is, because of corporate organization, there is a tendency for folks to either do Disney feature animation, to do Pixar, to do Lucasfilm, to do Marvel. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, during this period, as you mentioned, Lasseter and Catmull are put in charge of really all of Disney animation, right? So can you talk about the benefit of thinking about Disney animation in a more expansive and inclusive way, and what that might do for how we've studied Disney so far? I think you've made a really interesting point here about Ralph Breaks the Internet and how that kind of represents not only synergy but synthesis among these kinds of divisions.
I mean, taking into account that this wider Disney universe, in a way, is it really illuminates the diversity first of influences at work within Disney animated films. Traditionally, Disney animated films have indeed tended to be studied in isolation. You look at, for example, Frozen. Through the lens of all the previous Disney fairy tales. How does Frozen compare to Snow White, to Little Mermaid, etc.? Same thing. It does happen specifically for Disney fairy tales. They tend to really be studied in a in as Disney fairy tales. So looking into interactions with Pixar, with Marvel. I specifically focused on Pixar and Marvel, but I'm sure there would be very interesting studies to make looking at Lucasfilm in the future or of acquisitions. Who knows what will what Disney will acquire next? But that allows us to look at these films and discover new things that and also it helps us get a more complex picture of these films as well. If I take the example of the Disney fairy tales again, there was the cycle of Disney fairy tales released. So The Princess and the Frog, Tangled, and Frozen. I've come across several articles looking at them saying, yes, they're more modern. There's something happening, especially with the relationship between the male character and the princess. And actually, if you look at other influences, especially the Disney print, the Disney heroine, Frozen and Pixar's Brave, for example, have many things in common. There is a clear dialogue in these two films, the way they were produced, the role of female directors, the way they were received. There are interesting parallels. And to go back to the Disney couples, if you look at contemporary Hollywood romantic comedies of that times. There are also many interactions. I also look in the book. I also look at the influence of Enchanted, which is an interesting hybrid example, which is a live action. Pretty much most of it is a live action film, but the animated sequences are key to understand it. And so again. A film like Frozen, for example, is in dialogue, yes, with the whole history of Disney fairy tales, but also with Disney-produced live-action films like Enchanted, Pixar films like Brave, and also Marvel films. The superhero genre is a very strong influence on that film. So that's allows us to have a more complex picture. And also to understand how these films, especially I think the ones from that decade, do not easily fit into a category like they are progressive or they are regressive. They actually draw on so many different influences that are much more complex than they seem.
And so there's two dynamics there that we want to pull out. Let's start first with gender, right? So your book contributes to what arguably is the most vital area and the most vibrant area within Disney studies, which is this question of Disney studies and gender studies, right? We've had books and collections from Amy Davis, Johnson Chiu, Sharon Roberts, Robin Muir. I'm wondering, how do you see your work kind of in dialogue with the pretty substantial tradition of feminist and gender studies analyses of Disney?
Yeah, so obviously I draw on these very important works, especially Amy Davis, Amy Davis's books, both on female characters and male characters as well in Disney. So I draw on them, and also I try to expand the dialogue and looking at other film genres as well. Because again, what is so interesting and what is specific about, I would say, Disney animated films and Disney animated, well, female characters, as opposed to maybe animated characters from other studios, is that they always engage with that history of characters, especially the princesses, because they come with a history of animated films. They come with a massive merchandising empire, you could almost say. And so it's always there when you have those films. They're always in dialogue with their past and the history of those representations. A concept that I think is interesting in terms of looking at gender representation is the concept of post-feminism, which I borrow from authors who look at other types of, whether mainstream films or media, so authors like Evan Tasker, Diane Negra, Stephanie Gaines, who use that concept to describe specific contemporary sensibilities related to representations of femininity, which fuse empowerment rhetoric with traditionalist identity paradigms. So that entanglement, they speak about that entanglement of feminist and anti-feminist ideas. So I use that concept in terms of a spectrum, really, looking at how all those films from Disney can be put on a kind of post-feminist spectrum, and how in one film you can have those moments who draw on those more traditionalist representations, draw on the past of the Disney fairy tales, will reproduce more stereotypical, more conservative portrayals of women and coupledom, heteronormative relationships. And at the very same time, that film will also have more moments or sequences that will tend towards the other end of the spectrum. And this is where I argue in the book comes in the influence from other genres, from action films, from superhero films, from other strands of romantic comedies. So this is how I would do that. So I build on these very important works, but I try to make also a connection with concepts that are not always used in Disney studies or not as often, and trying to think about how the same film, again, or different characters in the same film can draw on different different influences.
So I'm hoping we can maybe take a moment from the kind of the big picture discussion we've been having and think about a case study. So mm-hmm. I'm gonna deal you Rapunzel, Tiana, or Elsa, but can you take one of those characters and run with it and give us a little sense of what you do with understanding genre, gender, and storytelling in their respective film?
That's a very tough choice. Okay.
Pick your favorite.
So if you look at Elsa, well, I'll talk about Frozen again. Frozen is on the cover of the book, so it's a very important film for that decade, and it's very important, and it has been talked about a lot. So Elsa, again, if you use the Disney fairy tale framework for that film, and looking at Elsa, well, she does not fit in quite easily. She's not paired in a heteronormative relationship. So the Disney fairy tale doesn't quite work with her. The relationship with a male partner is not relevant in her storyline. Her storyline focuses on her relationship with her sister, Anna. So for her character, it's important to draw on other genre and generic influences in order to understand how she functions within the film. So for her character, I look at two main trends, the superhero genre and specific trends of the romantic comedies, which focus on female friendships, female relationships. So the superhero genre, there are very interesting parallels between Elsa as a superhero who throughout the film, if you look at the narrative of becoming of superheroes, she has those new powers that she has to try to understand and master. The concept of mastery of powers, of potential danger, unruliness are central within the superhero genre. The idea is how the superhero can harness their powers to effectively perform their roles to save people and do what is right. This is a trajectory that you have through the film, and that expands with Let It Go, which is that amazing sequence where she finally experiments with her powers, and you often have those sequences in superhero films where you have the superhero experimenting with his or her superpowers and gaining confidence and in that mastery. And in there, you have a superimposition when you have the superhero, but you also have the musical. So that's the Disney element in here, the musical, very important. The superhero element and the self-reflexive element as well, because what does she do? She animates the snow. She animates a snowman. She's like a digital animation, creating a fantastic ice castle and a very very elaborate sparkling dress before the eyes of the viewers. So there's that element as well. And also, if we think about her relationship with her sister, I make parallels in the book with a strand of also women's films, but you also have that in romantic comedies from the 2000s and the 2010s, where the focus tends to be on the female heroine and her relationship with her friends or with her family. You have that in Bridesmaids is an example. That is the most famous example. You have all romantic comedies that focus on multiple characters, and you will have one or more characters that will remain single or that who will prioritize friendships over finding romantic partners. So How to Be Single is another example. So that's how we can understand a character as complex as Elsa, because if we stick to the Disney fairy tale framework, obviously she draws onto that, and she's a highly subversive character who is closer to Disney female villains as well. There have been interesting things written on that. Catherine Lester's chapter comes to mind on Frozen. But she draws on a different tradition. So that's a very subversive character in terms of the fairy tale, because she departs from the Disney princess to become something else. But what is so interesting in Frozen is that you get two female characters. You still get to have Anna, who will be the princess, the more cheerful, naive princess, who will get married, who will have, and her storyline is the sister, but also the two male partners in the first film. So you get to have everything with Frozen. So on the post-phonic spectrum, it's all over the place. I hope this answers your question, but I cannot speak about Elsa without talking about Anna as well.
No, I think it opens up a lot more questions as well, right? Because one of the things my students and I often talk about is in the Disney Renaissance, we get the heterosexual romance plot, right? Mm-hmm. And of course, thinking about Rick Altman and Tom Schatz, right? The musical is always already, at least in a Hollywood context, a romantic comedy, right? Mm-hmm. It's always kind of premised on that, what Altman calls the dual focus narrative, right? But then you get to this period that you've focused on in your book. And, you know, we get Merida, we get Elsa, we get Moana. And then after your period that you're focusing on, you know, you also get Mirabel, right? But they're all strong female leads who are not motivated by pursuing a heterosexual partner, right? They're motivated largely by familial love and by self-determination and self-realization. So I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more about how you see these changes in genre and these changes in gender during this period, and how you understand Disney kind of moving away from the heterosexual romance plot as the structuring mechanism of generic storytelling during this time.
So I think there are, I would say maybe there are two things. First of all, if you think about the, so I'll start with the fairy tale ones. So Prince and the Frog, Tangled, and Frozen. Those films have to. So there are musicals, there are fairy tales, and they have romance in them. So on the on at first level, these are what you expect from Disney fairy tale musicals. But these Disney fairy tales come after a decade of Shrek that explicitly satirized this specific what you, exactly what you described, the representation of fairy tale romance, heteronormativity with songs, the musical element. So Shrek mocked that very explicitly. So Disney has to come across, come after a decade of very explicit, sometimes heavy-handed parody, and try and do, how can you do naive and sincere after, you know, having a having a princess singing so loud that she kills a bird, or you know, so many other examples that you get from Shrek. So that's that obstacle, that first obstacle. And Frozen follows from that in a way. Well, you have the in The Princess and the Frog, you do have the prince who is this character who's potentially a masquerade, because in most of the film, the real prince is a frog, and the real Prince Naveen is actually his servant, is in disguise. Then in Tangled, you have also as well that Flynn slash actually Eugene, that character who's not a prince and who is very much influenced by DreamWorks in the humor that he uses and the way he evolves. And then in Frozen, you have Hans, Prince Hans, who's the villain, and the explicit, and not the villain in the fun way that you get in Shrek when you have the Prince Charming, who's very pathetic and very mocked. He's not, he's dangerous, but he's mocked a lot as well. Hans is unexpectedly a villain, and he's killed. I mean, not he's not killed. Sorry, he's eradicated. He's eradicated in Frozen. So the fact that we have that, the epitome of chivalry, fairy tale masculinity is eradicated with Frozen. This is no longer the, at least in animation, this is no longer the ideal. So we have all the films after coming after Frozen, who which no longer focus on romance. I think also in part, well, coming from the influence of Pixar as well, the romance in Brave is in the background. What matters is the relationship between the mother and the daughter. But Frozen has so much success and is so influential and comes then out with a sequel that I think this is the first element that eradicates at least this nostalgic ideal of Disney romance as represented within the very conventional expected representation of romance and gender. This is no longer the there is the, those sequences of love ballet in Frozen actually, well, you actually re realizing that this is the villain performing his villain song as well in Frozen with a Love is an Open Door. So you can no longer have that afterwards. at least in animation. In live action remakes, it's another story. So that's that first thing, you know, the parody, the satire. How does Disney deals with the parody and the satire and eradicates at least that stereotypical character? And then the second influence, I think, is moving away from romance because it borrows from action and the action genres, and the equivalent of the romantic pair is the buddy pair, is the buddy relationship. So instead of having romances in films like Moana, you have Maui and Moana, who function as the pair of action buddy comedy. You have the most explicit example would be Zootopia with Judy and Nick. So you have that with, in Moana, you have Maui and Moana. And the most explicit example of the buddy relationship is Nick and Judy in Zootopia. In Big Hero 6, you have a team of friends, so no longer any romance. You also kind of, I don't talk about it in the book, this is not my main case study, but you also have that in Bolt, with Bolt and Mittens, the cat. So you have all those films which shift from the romantic pair to the buddy. And there are many parallels between those because you, in those contemporary fairy tales, those romantic pairs, very much inspired by contemporary rom-coms and screwball relationships who don't get along at the beginning, are very different, opposed in every way, but they have to work together and then they ultimately fall in love. You have that with Naveen and Tiana, you have that with Flynn and Rapunzel, and you have that with Anna and Kristoff. And this is where the shift from Hans to Kristoff is interesting. And then you have also that with all the films I quoted before. So you have buddies. Again, Judy and Nick, they don't get along. They're opposed in every way. A rabbit and the fox in Zootopia don't get along, opposed in every way, but they have to work together to help each other out. And then they form an effective partnership and become friends at the end. So there's also that shift, that buddy friendship, buddy relationship, which is central in action films. You are in action films, you either have the team, the superhero team, or the action buddies. So moving away from fairy tale romance, eradicating the prince, and then getting this influence from action genres and moving from romance to buddies. I hope this answers your question.
It gives me a lot to think about, but the thing I want to talk about, because I'm biased, is the musical. Because I'm thinking of Jennifer Flieger's work, right, where she argues that the early Disney princess has an operatic vocal performance, mm-hmm. and then moves into a Broadway style in the Disney Renaissance. And then when we get to Tangled, we get a pop vocal, right? In part because we have Mandy Moore. Mm-hmm. It strikes me that the period you're talking about, we see a return to the Broadway musical, but I'm interested to see what you think about the relationship between Disney and the musical in this period.
Indeed. In Frozen, obviously, with Idina Menzel voicing Elsa, that is definitely the case. But so that's an interesting interesting question. And actually, when I looked at the musical within my book, I actually looked at parallels between musicals and action genres. So kind of deviating from that. From that perspective, so I have to admit I haven't looked into that in detail as much.
Perhaps you can just give us some general thoughts then on what the musical means in this moment. You know, and we can leave Professor Flieger to answer the vocal performance question in her future work.
I mean, the musical is still integral to Disney. That's for sure. It's interesting to see though that in that period, the films do alternate. It seems that they are still essential, But you do also have a couple of films that are not musicals: Zootopia, Bolt, Big Hero 6, the first Ralph Breaks the Internet. So obviously, there are generic parallels between action films and musicals. Numerous authors have looked into these parallels, and I try to look at it in the book as well. I think it is still central, definitely. And again, if you look at the films that have, especially at the with the remakes, the remakes that have been the most successful are the ones that have been musicals: Aladdin, The Lion King. So it's interesting to see. I think they are here to stay as far as Disney is concerned, because there is still that aspect of, when you mentioned synergy earlier, obviously, if you have a musical, you also have the Broadway adaptation that is possible. You have the CDs, you have the music, you have the performances in the box, at the box. So it invites further synergistic possibilities that you would not have as easily with a film like Zootopia, even if you have one very famous pop song, that Shakira's Try Everything, and that it is a very important song narratively in the film. It plays a very important role, but it's a Zootopia musical, a Broadway adaptation would be more difficult than, let's say, an Encanto adaptation. So I think it is still central for these reasons. And also, the musical has always been and still continues to be, with the example of Frozen and Encanto and Moana, that moment of also female empowerment and self-determination. It is the most iconic sequences tend to be those musical sequences. I mean, Let It Go might be, if there's one sequence maybe that encapsulates that decade of Disney, it is Let It Go, because the song has been heard by so many times, and it's the most, to me at least, it's the most interesting in the film in terms of aesthetic, and it's so, every time it's so essential in the development of the female character. So yeah, I hope it answers your question.
Yeah, it gives us a lot to think about, you know, you kind of gesture to in your answer, but I'm hoping Encanto ends up on Broadway. If Disney doesn't put Encanto on Broadway, they're fools. but I also was struck, and because I read a lot of Noel Brown's work, right? Mm-hmm. Your thoughts on Disney animation and how it intersects with this question of the children's film and the family film, and in my own research, I've gotten an opportunity to interview a lot of folks who work at Disney, and they really are ambivalent about being considered children's entertainers, right? Mm-hmm. They really push against that. And that goes back to Walt, right? We can find evidence of Walt doing the same thing. I'm curious your thoughts on the usefulness and the utility of considering Disney animated films to be children's films and family films.
So that's a tough question, because I assume that the people you interview tend to stay away from that term, because it tends to be, even in academia, it tends to be associated with very pejorative connotations. If it's a children's film, well, it's commercial, it's not very clever, it's a limited audience. In the same way, obviously not always, as they are very interesting and developed and thorough studies of children's films, but this tends to be those kind of generic labels like chick flicks, or that tend to equate a specific assumed target audience and the content, and they come with also pejorative connotations. Chick flick is can have that ambivalence as well. For the purpose of the book, because there are very interesting studies of children's films, and Disney tend to have tend to be often included in those studies. My aim in the book was to look at genres beyond what tends to be associated with Disney. And obviously, if you look again, you take any academic book on children's films or family films, there will be at least one chapter on Disney. And these are very useful labels. Obviously, I disagree that these are pejorative connotations, but I mean, to me, that it's a generic label. It's not pejorative, but it's often used even in popular writing and journalism. It tends to be used in a pejorative way. I tend to look. I with the book, I try to look at other genres, to look at things that are, to look at new things in those films, because obviously they tend to be categorized as children films. So they have been studied alongside other children films, other family films. But I thought that saying, for example, if I say Frozen is a rom-com, let's say, how useful is that? What can it show that you wouldn't understand if you were sticking to children film, for example? So that was my personal approach. And so also raising the, I think maybe another reason why those, it is difficult to solely categorize those films as children films. There are children films, but there are also many other things, is that the audience is much wider. I mean, family film maybe might be, for those Disney animated films, maybe family films might be a little bit more accurate, because especially with the films in the 2000s, they have so many self-reflexive elements. They draw on so many other generic influences that the audiences, all sections of audiences will get something out of them. I think, especially fairy tales, to fully appreciate. Obviously, Frozen can be appreciated by very young children, as it has been a lot. But the audience reaction was so strong because older children and young adults and parents were expecting something specific with that film, and they were surprised because it did not stick to what was expected in terms of the prince and what we mentioned earlier. So what label to choose is never innocent. It's always calculated. I remember reading one of the first Frozen's description in the trailer. The blurb said it's a action-packed adventure comedy, which is not wrong, but it's a very specific way to enter the film, saying that Frozen is an action-packed comedy. So if you say children films, it will connote other things. If you say it's a romance or a musical, it will also connote and give another window to the film. So it is definitely a useful category, but and very hybrid as well. Children films obviously can englobe so many different things. So it can be useful, but in my personal work, I try to look at genres that were not necessarily as much associated with Disney.
And so as we head into the home stretch, I'm going to ask you a bit of an unfair question, which is that, you know, from 2018 to 2024, we've mm-hmm. seen the release of more Disney animated mm-hmm. films, of course, mm-hmm. You know, thinking of films like Encanto and Turning Red and Wish. I'm wondering if you could offer us some kind of tentative thoughts about how, you know, if you were to write a coda, because mm-hmm. books take a long time to mm-hmm. write, finish, and get through the production process. Is anything kind of striking you in what Disney has released more recently Do you see it as a kind of a continuity of the arguments you're making here, or do you think that there are some interesting pivots or changes that you would address in future work?
So I will admit I have not seen Wish yet, so I will not be able to
me neither.
talk about it. Okay, but thinking about Encanto, even Raya and the Last Dragon, Turning Red is Pixar, but obviously there is dialogue there. It seems to me so far that it follows the two main trends, at least the second trend I had looked at in the book, which was basically that decade, 2008-2018, it's Disney revising its canon for the fairy tale part, revising with parody, with satire, and also expanding the canon. So that's where you get the superhero influence, the action genre, the buddy comedy, cop films with Zootopia. And it seems to me that it continues to expand. Raya and the Last Dragon is very close to the action genre, looking at other variations of action adventure, but pretty much in that mode. But we seem to have in terms of the animation, and that's where I think it's important to specify that in terms of the animation, we continue to veer towards action adventure and further away from fairy tale romance. Frozen 2 obviously is the exception to that. But in terms of new content, original content, it seems that I would be very curious to see how they can produce another romance, fairy tale romance in animation after Frozen, because of all the things we talked about. So again, I have yet to see Wish. This might be wrong if I watch Wish, but in terms of the other films, it seems that veering towards action adventure and staying away from fairy tales, which is the opposite, not exactly the opposite, but if you look at the live action remakes, for example, this is where the fairy tale romance are back in a way. The animation is going away from that. And then you have films like Aladdin and The Little Mermaid who restage the romance and the weddings and with the strong influence of action, obviously, but you still have that. This is where it seems that it is in the live action remakes that you get the romance and the unknown sense that you no longer get in animation. So that's what I would say. I'm surprised there haven't been more Marvel animated adaptations, to be honest. I was expecting more films like Big Hero 6. This has not happened yet, but that's something that surprised me. So it seems to... So maybe that could be something that they look into in the future, but I was honestly expecting more Marvel, explicit Marvel within the animation. But they seem to be, again, action, adventure, musicals, and moving away from romance.
Yeah, it seems with the success that Sony's having with the Spider-Verse films that Disney will not avoid that for too long or too much longer. And then, of course, the live-action remakes, we know pretty well, we have to say with an asterisk and quotation marks because they're so heavily animated.
Yes, of course. Yeah, when I say live-action remake, of course, I do not include Lion King, which is an animated remake. But you're right. I forgot about Spider-Verse. It's interesting you say that because to me it would have been an opposite argument because Spider-Verse is so unique in terms of aesthetic that maybe Disney would not want to dare do something like that because of comparisons. But you're right. But it would be difficult. It's true that Sony Spider-Verse is so unique and has been critically acclaimed. There will be a third film coming. It would be interesting to see what Disney would do in terms of animated superhero films. That is, again, Disney. I'm not, obviously, there are Star Wars animation and Marvel, but yeah, it would be difficult for them. But I was expecting, yeah, before Spider-Verse, I was expecting, you know, more like that. But
yeah, yeah.
I think films like Encanto are better, are better endeavors, at least. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and what I was saying, just to clarify, for those who are listening, is like, you know, even in the live action remakes, quote unquote, right, like Beauty and the Beast or Aladdin, we're still seeing an intense amount of digital animation. I don't
course.
Know how we've come across this term live action remake, but it of course is at best is a hybrid, right? So my final question for you, my final question for all my interviewees is, what are you currently working on? Are you continuing to work on contemporary Disney animation, or has your scholarly interest been drawn elsewhere?
So I'm working, so I have a couple of work in progress chapters that are either finished and about to be published or in the process of writing that on Disney. So I have one which is based on expands the work I've done on Big Hero 6, but looking at other characters. I have another chapter on actually comparing, so that's for the Oxford Handbook of Disney Musicals, looking at animated sequels. So looking at, actually I'm taking where I left it with where I left the book, so Frozen 2, Ralph Breaks the Internet, and comparing them with Aladdin and Beauty and the Beast from the perspective of the musical, and how the musical sequence is used to rework the Disney canon and the Disney formula. I have another chapter on the Disney Princess coming as well for 2025, and after that, I might look into other scholarly ventures and looking at studios in the European context. So basically, after spending time to think about what defines Disney and what makes Disney Disney in terms of animation and reception and genre, I want to look at that same period, but looking at other studios and how independent studios have tried to create an identity and how they survive. So especially looking at Cartoon Saloon from the Irish studio is one I'm particularly interested in. How those European studios, Aardman would be another example, but how these European studios stand out with creating a brand identity and a recognizable, blending that with a recognizable aesthetic that stays away from digital animation, or at least explicitly in the design and the techniques, explicitly stands away from the digital animated aesthetic that has been identified with Disney and Pixar. So looking at the other side of the Atlantic, that might be the next big project.
Wonderful. Well, I hope when you finish it, you'll come back on the podcast.
I hope so too.
Thank you so much for your time today, Eve. The book is My pleasure. The book is Contemporary Disney Animation, Genre, Gender, and Hollywood, available now from Edinburgh University Press and other online booksellers. This is Pete Kunze, and this has been New Books in Film on the New Books Network. Thank you for listening, and we hope you'll join us again next time.